The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Robert Poby. He joins us on the telephone near Montreal in Canada. Hello, Robert.
How are you doing, Vic?
Much better now that I got you on the phone, Robert. How's the weather up in Canada? Is it hot up there, too?
We're doing good today. Everybody's locked inside like in the States, or like you're supposed to be in the States, but we're doing all right.
Good. Now, you have a book that just came out called Under Pressure, and it's a Lucas Page novel, and I hate to admit that this is the first of your books that I've read. Is this the second book in a series?
Yeah, this is the second book in the Lucas Page series, absolutely.
Okay, and what was the first book?
The first one was called City of Windows. It was
All
released
right.
Summer last year.
Okay.
We should specify that Lucas has some prosthetics. Somebody commented and emailed to me last week that he has prosthetics on his prosthetics. But Lucas has some prosthetics due to what we refer to in the book as the event. And we don't know what it is. We never really describe it. We just know there was a rough period of life about 10 years ago for Lucas, and that forced him to retire from the FBI and to, you know, pick up the life that he has now.
All right. So reading Under Pressure, I see the event, and I recognized fairly quickly that this was probably something that you have not really gotten into in any detail. And so that's true as far as how he was injured.
Yeah, no. I know when Lucas knows, but I don't think very many other people do.
So, like in book 10 or 11 or 12, you're just going to keep throwing out little tidbits?
I may or I may not. I mean, there's a rule in writing, or at least there's a rule that I follow with the type of fiction that I do, that you don't have to let the reader know everything. You just have to let them know enough.
Okay.
And so we know Lucas was hurt. Is it going to impact us or how a story unfolds? Maybe someday in the future, and I will end up revealing what happened to him. I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Robert Poby joins us. His new novel is Under Pressure. Who is Lucas Page? Give us his bio.
Lucas. Lucas was he was an adopted orphan. He was a savant, a mathematical savant as a child. He's grown up. He's become an astrophysicist, best-selling author. And he used to work for the FBI until about 10 years ago when his career was ended. So now he teaches at Columbia. He raises his five foster children and saves the city of New York time and again.
And tell us about his partner.
Alice Whitaker. Whitaker's just this, tough chick who chews on bullets for breakfast and is less, I'm going to say less cerebral, but she's more, I'm not going to say even a bodyguard for him, but she's his guardianing angel and chaperone. She kind of looks out for him. And he gets partnered with her at the FBI all the time. Their handler, Brett Kehoe, thinks they make a good team, and I think they do because she doesn't suffer prickliness, I guess would be, prickliness.
When I said partner, I guess I should have said spouse.
Aaron. He's got a wife who's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon who, unfortunately, I don't know how she manages, but she picks up most of the work at home while he's, busy stopping bad guys.
I had Ed McBain on the show about 20 years ago, and he said that when he wrote a mystery, he always tried to start off with a corpse fairly quickly, and you do that, but you multiply by about 700.
Yeah, 702, exactly, yeah. Well, nothing loses impact with bigger numbers,
Uh-huh.
Even though it's a statistic, a bombing is a bombing, and 700 dead people is a way to get into a book, I think.
Okay, and this is set in the current time, right?
Yes.
Because
yes.
I noticed, I'm a very close reader, and I noticed somewhere, you must have, gotten a hold of the printing press and said, we need to put the word coronavirus in here somewhere.
Actually, no. What happened is I was doing final edits in March when coronavirus was coming down.
Oh.
And I had a screensaver, a screenshot that I had tackled maybe about a month earlier when the virus in China went from 111 to 204 overnight. And that's like exponential spread for a virus. So I thought that that was coming down, and then things started to go bad. And then during the edits, I talked to my editor. I said, oh, look, we should put a couple of things in here. And he wasn't 100% sure. I'm glad I pushed for them. I wish I would have pushed, somebody wearing a mask further on in the book, too.
Okay. Well, we can't plan these things, can we?
No, we can't.
All right. So let's set the scene here. I'm not going to say exactly what happened to these 700 people, but it happens fairly quickly. What's our basic storyline here?
A basic storyline is there's a what looks like to be a terrorist attack. There's a bomb that's set off at a gala party, at an after-hours gala party at a museum in New York City. And there's just so many victims that the FBI is not sure if one of the victims was an intended target. With that many people, they have to run down all the data, and they need somebody who can really crunch numbers. They've got, 200 agents on it, but when you're dealing with 700 victims, it's a very big gene pool of information. So Lucas gets called back in to take a look at it and see what happens.
Have you read the Martin Beck series of novels?
No, I haven't.
Okay, they're Swedish from the 60s and 70s. There's a character in there named Melander, and he's one of these guys. He can look at a sheet of paper or he can look at a book, and 5 minutes later he can recite to you every single bit of information that was there. And this is a talent that Lucas has. Lucas demonstrates it at one point.
Yes,
and you just go, oh, my. What a brain.
Well, there's a lot of people like that out there. I remember seeing this guy on I think he was on Letterman, and he was talking about he came for 9.5 hours. He went through pi, but 3.14. And I think he went through, I forget if it was 9,000 or 19,000 decimal places from just, sitting there rambling off, doing nothing but taking breaks to eat bananas and milk. So there's some remarkable people out there. I mean, people watch the film Rain Man and think it's complete fiction. There's people with mathematical acuity that's just off the charts. And so Lucas is one of those guys, absolutely.
In case you're just tuning in, Robert Pobey joins us in the Book Nook today. His new Lucas Page novel is Under Pressure. It's number 2 in this series. And I think the thing that really kept me turning the pages was that even though we're talking about some very serious crimes and some dastardly people, and we don't really know who these dastardly people are, but they're crazy bombers. They like blowing up bombs. And as we're going through this really serious material, you have this really humorous way of writing. I don't think you can get through a page without you making some kind of a joke or some kind of a crack. I love this style.
Yeah, I'm not going to say no to that. You're absolutely right, yeah.
That's great. It's so entertaining. And Lucas, who supposedly doesn't really have a sense of humor and is hard-pressed to even smile, he's actually pretty funny.
Yes, I like spending time with him. I couldn't spend so much time with – I'm not your typical writer. I find they're mostly a bunch of, pasty-faced guys that sit inside and never do anything. And I live a pretty big life. And so if I'm going to spend a lot of time with somebody, it's got to be somebody that's going to impress me a little bit. And Lucas is he's pretty hilarious sometimes. I'm not going to say no.
He's also a guy who has some tension between him and his boss. And his boss is somehow able to coerce Lucas into participating in investigations when he really doesn't want to have anything to do with the FBI. And this is clearly a relationship where there's a lot of tension. And it's fun to read as a reader. This is sort of a classic setup, though, don't you think, where there's a lot of tension with the boss?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I intentionally had fun with it with Lucas, too, in that his boss, he needs his boss to ask. Because Lucas, when you really look at the big picture, this is where he shines, where he performs to the best standards, and where he's happiest. So his boss, as much as his boss is trying to coerce him into coming back, he's also always waiting for his boss to ask him to come back. I think that's part. I'm just starting to realize that about Lucas.
Robert, I don't know how many books you've written. I don't know what kind of genres they were in. Tell us about how you became a writer and just what exactly it is that you're into.
Well, good. The big question. I'll try to be, as brief as I can. I wanted to be a writer my whole life. I didn't really realize it until college. But it was just something I was writing short stories for years. And I accidentally wrote my first novel when I was in my early 20s. And when I say accidentally, I mean I was in school and I decided to, spend my evenings as an undergrad doing something. And when I finished, I was having dinner with one of my professors. And when I took him out to thank him for the classes that year, and I mentioned I wrote a book, and he says, well, I'd like to read it. And I'm like, oh, you don't want to read this flatulent student fiction. There's no way. And so I gave him a copy of the book. I dropped it by his office, and about 4 days or 5 days later, I was living at home. I'm 22, and I got a call. At 3 o'clock in the morning, my mother wakes me up and says, there's a guy on the phone. And it was my professor, Malcolm. He says, look, if you don't send this book out, you're an idiot. Uh-huh. And the first people I sent it to sent me a three-book contract and a check. And that was kind of how it started. That being said, I put in hundreds and thousands of hours before then into writing and reading. Then my publisher was bought out about 8 months later, and they did. And five new authors they had purchased, none of them went to print. And so for 20 years, I kept writing, but I never showed my work to anybody. And then 10 years ago, life kind of stepped in the way. There was a few bumps and dents along the way, and I figured I better start, you know, if I want to put some backbone into writing, I'm getting older, if I want to get published, I should try now. And that's basically what happened.
Well,
as far as, now, as far as influences along the way, I mean, everybody from, I mean, Mario Puzo to Ernest Hemingway to William Faulkner, there's been, you know, thousands of great books on the way. You know that. You're a book person. It's impossible not to get caught up in this whole thing.
I looked at your website, and I see that you listed some writers on your website that you admire, that have maybe been influences on you. And there are actually a couple of them on there that I've interviewed.
Well, far of who?
Jimmy Breslin and Christopher Hitchens.
You interviewed? Wow. Those are like two big that's amazing. And now, was Hitch easy to interview?
Yeah, I think he might have had a couple of martinis before.
Well, he's always looked like a sweaty drunk. I have another friend that was on a TV show with him, got into a big argument. He says, guy walked and he looked like a sweaty drunk, but he could put a very compelling argument together.
Yeah, he really could. Brilliant man.
And Jimmy Breslin's just like, a master of American letters. Anybody who says anything disparaging about Jimmy Breslin, to me, really has an argument ahead of them.
Well, Jimmy, he was a little crusty.
Absolutely. But
yeah.
He did the work. I mean, his talent was undeniable.
Well, he was a classic New York guy, and I'm sure you must understand what that means, because I got him on the phone and I was chit-chatting with him before we started recording the interview, and he says, if you don't stop being so nice to me, I'm going to hang up.
That sounds like something you would have said, yeah.
But I did get him to talk about Son of Sam and how Son of Sam was after him. And that was,
oh, yeah, Berkowitz. I mean, because of Jimmy Breslin, I mean, that's one of the reasons he probably got caught. But, I mean, Breslin's the guy that argued that it was actual news. It wasn't leering at the serial murder to publish his letters.
Yeah. In this book, I would say the city of New York is definitely its own character. What's the significance of New York City to you as a writer?
Well, I mean, it's the modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah. We've all grown up. I mean, we're all children of late 20th, early 21st century television and film. So, I mean, New York has just been the city. My parents also had an apartment there for 23 years. I had three cars stolen in New York. I have a lot of experience with the city. So it is, New York is a very serious, very big town. And it grows on you for better or for worse. And it definitely is its own character. There's no place... I've been around the world, and there's not a city that can compare to New York. So it's just, I let it take over when I write about it. It's half love story, half condemnation, but it's definitely something that I feel.
We have all these bombings taking place in your book, and you cite Ted Kaczynski, who was known as the Unabomber. Can we talk at all about some of the social themes that underlie the story? Is that giving away too much?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, let's talk about some of those, because social media is one big thing. Technology is another big thing, and of course, they're very much interwoven.
Yeah. Well, the intersection, this is the problem. Whenever the greatest common denominator gets involved in anything, you can see it start to fall apart. We look at the internet. It was initially a platform for academics to share ideas and thoughts and research, and we can see how that's devolved into... You know, it's a place to buy sneakers and post, naked photographs of somebody you're sleeping with. So it's kind of been a race to the bottom. And so in Under Pressure, I kind of tackle that. And then, there is this worship of technology. We've got conspiracy theorists coming out of the woodwork. We've got, everything from revolutions to flash mobs being organized via Twitter. So those are some of the things I focus on. It's an interesting landscape right now, especially if you look politically, how social media is used. I couldn't say no to that in the context of the book.
Well, I think it's very timely. And despite the whole coronavirus thing, I think that we have a lot of stuff in here that just feels so current. You have references to this QAnon group, which is really in the news right now.
Yeah, they've been scaring me for a couple of years.
And I was impressed that you had them in there. And then I think you have fun. There's a couple of instances in there where people who are involved, obviously, with technology and weird groups have things happen to them. One is at the beginning where this guy is protesting that this is all fake and something happens to him. And then you have this guy at the end, the YouTube guy. I'm sorry. I had to laugh.
No. There's reason for this. I mean, I don't understand. I look at Instagram influencers. I guess the thing you're talking about is an Instagram influencer or YouTube influencer is trying to get some cool footage while they're bothering the police, and it turns out badly for them. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And these Instagram influencers, I mean, I've watched a couple of these people, and I think how miserable it must be to spend 10 minutes alone in their own heads with themselves. I don't understand how these people function in the world because they are – I don't understand what they're producing. I really don't. So, yeah, no, the modern American – I want to say consumerism because it's not just about consumerism, but the obsession with celebrity is tackled a little bit in the book. And, I mean, the serial killer's kind of become the, you know, late 20th, early 21st century movie star. More people know about – could name Ted Bundy than could name, you know, somebody from the House of Representatives, I think.
That reminds me, a number of years ago, I had Ann Rule on the program, and she worked with Ted Bundy. She wrote True Crime.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. She said one time.
I think she said, too, it's the one time in her life she was thrilled that she wasn't somebody's type.
Yeah, well, she said one time Ted offered to give her daughter a ride home. You think about that. Oof.
That's one of those moments you have to play back and forth in your head for the next 100 years without whether you want to or not. It's the gift that keeps on giving. You know?
Right. I think if I had to pick a favorite character in this story, it would be the guy who's the head of this really rich family.
William Hockney.
Yeah, I really like this character. Can we talk at all about the Hockneys?
Sure. The Hockneys are a successful... business brotherhood, two brothers who, you know, built an American empire, much like either you can think of any of the, you know, from the Rothschilds to the Koch brothers. And I'm not getting into conspiracy theories. I know the Rothschilds are always brought up they're just big industrialists that have made it in America. And they live in a gilded cage on top of the city, basically. And they, you know, I call them stealth billionaires. If you look at Manhattan, it's probably cut up by 15 or 20 people who own the biggest percentage of real estate, and the rest is everybody else. So they're one of these families that just controlled vast empires and don't even – their money can't even be counted.
Uh-huh. And they are really a central part of this story, and readers will discover what that's all about. But you keep us wondering. I think you did a really good job of hiding – Who was really behind all this intrigue in this story and just the whole plot, how complicated it was. And Lucas actually brings in a couple of young savants near the end of the story who really have the skills.
Yeah.
And this was another fun aspect of the story, this young man and young woman that he brings in, and just their focus and how well they work together with Lucas. These were his students, correct?
Yeah, they're two PhD students of his. And the reason I brought them back is I got so much supportive and positive email from readers about that really enjoyed that aspect of it. I thought, I'll bring them back in book two. And then a spot popped up that I needed them. It's like they were right there. So that was awfully nice. But he enlists the help of two astrophysics students who are both good with math, and one's good with algorithms, one's good with data, and they actually help the FBI crack the case because they look at things from a non-institutional or a non-bureaucratic point of view.
They were also in the first book, City of Windows.
Yes, they were.
Okay. And I'm a close reader. I like to maybe catch an homage in there. I'm thinking maybe you have some homages hidden in this story. Like there was one I picked up where I said to myself, okay, that's got to be an homage because why would he pick that name? There's someone whose name is given, and it's given just once, and then you keep moving, and we don't even see this person again, but you call this person Williford. And I thought, is this a tribute to Charles Williford?
It actually is because if you remember where that happens in the book, you're not quite sure which way a character is going to go, whether the character is alive or dead. And there's this great story that my editor told me about Williford a bunch of times, about how he put his character into a corner and his agent write this. He says, don't worry, I can get him out of it. So I that's why I used Williford in there. I thought it was a perfect scene for that.
That's very nice. And I'm sure all the critics get it, right?
You'd be surprised. I get some people pick up one name or one. You know, last book I had Rufus T. Firefly High School, so I got a lot of Groucho Marx fans writing and saying, "Congratulations, thank you, that was wonderful." But so I hide those little things in the books just because it's the way my brain was wired.
Nice. Another thing, I look for the little telling things because I read a lot of these kinds of books, and at one point I just said to myself, after the third or fourth mention, I said, "Okay, why is he carrying around these handcuffs?" I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, exactly. You've got foreshadowing. It's an important, you know, it's one of the things I need in my toolbox as a writer that I have to be able to do and do well, but not too well, just well enough that the guy goes, ah.
Mm-hmm. So what is the process for you? Do you outline? Do you just start from nothing? What do you do?
I don't outline at all. I shouldn't say at all. Maybe when I first start a book, I'll sit and I'll write a little bit as far as an outline goes, but outlines don't work in that. I never really see what's coming. I'll have like chapter 3, there'll be something exciting happen. I have no idea what's coming next with chapter 4 until I sit down to write it. So I'm not good at outlining. That being said, with a book like this, I had a pretty good idea who was going to be the serial bomber and how it was going to unfold. You know, I had probably maybe 3 or 4 scenes in my head, a couple of characters sketched out. And so I built the story around that. So it's not so much that I don't outline. I just sit down and I follow where the characters go. And I've been doing this long enough now that I kind of trust myself to get them out of trouble. I don't know if that works or not all the time, but so far it's done okay for me.
Well, I never thought about this until I read your book. And then I went on Google and did a little sleuthing myself. And it never really occurred to me that some of these crimes we've been seeing in the last 20 or 30 years were being committed by people that call themselves incels?
Yes.
And that never really occurred to me. And then I went and I looked and I was like, wait a minute, there's a lot of this. But you never really hear that term associated with most of these.
Well, incel's a new term. I think I heard it first time about 3 years ago. And it stands for it's an acronym for involuntary celibacy. It's these young men that feel that, you know, society or women or, you know, Mother Nature at large owes them sex, and they get angry that they're not having sex, hence the involuntary celibacy moniker, and they lash out. Most of the time they kill women, but they kill. And if you take a look at I've done some research into the motivation. ISIS, this is a country, or this is a part of the world where, you know, you can't even look at a woman's ankle, let alone, the female form or date. So a lot of these people, I think, are driven by rage. I think rage is an untapped motivator in a lot of books.
Hmm. My guest is Robert Pobey. We're talking about his new Lucas Page novel. It's called Under Pressure. It just came out. He joins us on the telephone up in the Montreal area in Canada. And I'm wondering what kind of stuff you like to read. Do you read in the genre? Do you have writers that you admire?
Oh, there's a lot of writers I admire. I mean, the guy that made me want to do this is a writer by the name of Trevanian.
Oh, sure.
He wrote his popular, but his most well-known book is probably Shibumi, but he also wrote a book called The Eiger Sanction, which is my favorite piece of, I'll say, genre fiction. Robert Ludlum was an influence when I was growing up. Mario Puzo, like I said. But I've gone on, I mean, Mickey Spillane's kind of one of the bedrock writers in my life. People don't see it, and I'm not going to say it translates to the way I write, but just that pragmatic way of approaching a story. I like Mickey Spillane's writing for stuff like that. Who else? Hunter S. Thompson. Uh-huh. There's no stopping Hunter S. Thompson. Norman Mailer. Uh-huh. I think Chapter 7 in Norman Mailer's Tough Guys Don't Dance is still probably some of the finest writing I have read. And then I can go back to Shelley or Keats. I like romantic poetry. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I mean, it's one of the greatest novels. It's in the top 5 greatest novels ever written in the English language. So it's across the board. I've got everything from Shakespeare to, I'm not going to say Judith Krantz, but let's say Mary. We'll stop at Mario Puzo as far as the spectrum goes.
Okay, well, I did note that I think almost all those people are dead.
Yeah, okay, living writers. Dennis Lehane is fabulous.
Okay, all right.
John Sanford. Let's see, who else? I'm reading that. David Morrell hasn't ever written a bad book, I think.
Okay.
I like Lee Child's Jack Reacher series. Mm-hmm. It's a very different series than the one I'm working on, but when you sit down with Jack, you kind of know what you're going to get. You can, you know, break out the scotch or the Coca-Cola or the Red Bull or whatever your poison is and just wait for him to break some people's bones. So that's always fun, too.
Well, I kept picturing Lucas and Jack Reacher drinking coffee together because, man.
yes, maybe. That's true. Jack doesn't drink. Not often. Yeah.
Not often.
Milk and coffee, that's it.
He likes his coffee. And Lucas, he lives on the stuff.
Yeah, he lives. Coffee is all his major food groups, absolutely.
Well, I'm amazed that Lucas made it through this story, frankly, because...
You know what? I am, too, and he almost didn't. There was a moment there I was like, is he going to make it? And I had to seriously consider it.
Well, I had a feeling maybe he's in book three already, and so you were kind of stuck there. You had to keep him going, right?
Yeah, well, not had to. I'm enjoying it. When I first started the series, I did not... When I was first offered a series, I really had to think about it because it wasn't on my radar as something I wanted to do. But my editor, Keith, really liked City of Windows. He says, look, you know, we should bring this character back. So I thought about it over the weekend, called him back and said, okay, let's pull the ripcord.
Initially, that was going to be a standalone?
Yes.
Okay. And is book three underway? Is it already written?
Book three is underway.
Okay.
I'm probably about 30% through it now. I'll be done probably end of November, I guess.
And is this going to be in New York, too?
Absolutely.
Okay.
New York, Lucas is a New York kind of guy. I don't see him really taking out of the context. He may be going to London in the future, but right now I like him in New York, and New York has enough to offer him that he can stay put and keep busy.
Now, if things were normal and we weren't having this pandemic, what kind of stuff would you have done to publicize this book, and what kind of stuff are you doing currently under this pandemic?
Good question. I'm not big on publicity, to be honest with you. It's not something I do a lot of, and it's not because I'm bad at it or I don't enjoy it. I don't really understand it. I understand the book that I wrote, and I understand, you know, who I am, but how the two relate to readers, it's kind of a weird triangle that I can't, you know, figure the geometry out. But usually, I mean, right now, there might have been a couple of book dates. I might have done, you know, maybe a couple of stores in New York City, probably one or two in Toronto, one or two in Montreal, uh-huh. Maybe gone to another larger Canadian town, San Diego. But other than that, these days it's a lot of blogs, and it's just things like, you know, radio gigs, Zoom interviews.
Uh-huh.
The world is changing around us.
So you're not real big on getting out and pressing the flesh.
No. I like the writing the book part. Like that. Yeah. That's where I feel most confident. That's where I know what I'm doing 100%. In the interviews, I never really know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Well, it's kind of like those of us who do the interviews. We have no clue what we're doing either.
I guess, you know what? That's probably not wrong when I try to reverse engineer it from a different perspective.
Well, I looked at your website and I saw on there where you said you don't really do many interviews. So
I think this is four, and I think I have two more booked, and that's it for this this year.
Well, I am honored that you're willing to do one with me, and I want to thank Hector, who has always taken good care of me, for making it possible.
Well, Hector is great, and one of the reasons I'm doing this is there's the support in the community for writers, like what you do, and I'm amazed at how giving the community, like the readers and the people that champion the books are. It's so having you out there is a very important part of all of this, too.
Well, I feel an obligation to turn listeners and readers on to the latest and greatest, and I highly recommend your new one, Under Pressure, Robert. And thank you so much for your time today.
Well, the pleasure was entirely mine. Thank you, Vic.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. Our book today was Under Pressure, the second Lucas Page novel by Robert Pobey. For The Book Nook, thanks for tuning in. I'm Vic McCunis.